glasses were just a dodge so we could wait for Vice Chairman Saxton. Anyway, thank you, and I want to welcome you, Mr. The hearing will come to order. I want to welcome Federal Chairman Ben Bernanke to this hearing of the Joint Economic Committee on the Economic Outlook. This committee has a broad mandate to study and make recommendations about economic policy, and we're always pleased when the Federal Reserve Chairman comes to share his views on the state of our economy. Chairman Bernanke, when you came before this committee last March, one of the major topics discussed was the potential fallout from the subprime lending crisis. It's something this committee has been very concerned with for quite some time, and I think you'd be the first to admit that the subprime mess has not been contained, but instead has proved to be contagion that has spread in dangerous ways throughout not just the housing market, but our economy and even into the global financial system. The seizing up of credit markets this summer was the first and clearest indication of the unanticipated and potentially disastrous risks that out-of-control subprime lending poses to financial markets. There is now a lack of confidence in creditworthiness throughout the markets, and at that core is a lack of confidence in the subprime mortgage market. Until we correct that, we will not solve our broader problems. I want to applaud you and the Federal Reserve Board for your aggressive and, I believe, appropriate response to this summer's liquidity crisis. It's vital that we maintain the health of our financial markets and to ensure that they function smoothly, and you deserve credit for your prompt actions. However, while we did weather that summer storm, I am worried that there may be a bigger storm on the horizon. Quite frankly, I think we are at a moment of economic crisis stemming from four key areas: falling housing prices, lack of confidence in creditworthiness, the weak dollar, and high oil prices. Each of these problems alone would be enough of a threat to our economic well-being, but taken together, they are essentially the four horsemen of the economic crisis. First, as we have warned and as you acknowledge in your testimony, we face a wave of foreclosures in the next years that threaten millions of American homeowners and their neighbors. The housing boom is busted, and we may see trillions of dollars in lost home values across the nation. Second, the credit markets remain in crisis. There's just simply a lack of confidence. Third, the dollar has dropped dramatically against most of the major currencies of the world and seems to hit lows not seen in decades nearly every day. And finally, oil prices keep reaching near record highs, driving up energy costs in all sectors of the economy. Even our bedrock assumptions are being put into doubt. As housing prices decline, there are real fears we won't be able to depend on consumers, the engine of our economy over the past few years, to keep spending. And we now hear that foreign investors may no longer be confident in the dollar as the global currency of choice. I'm not surprised to hear experts such as your predecessor, Alan Greenspan, warn about the threat of recession. I've begun to worry about it too. In particular, as I watch bank after bank write down bad investments tied to Baroque financial instruments that even sophisticated investors don't understand, I fear about the stability and ultimate confidence in our financial system. I've talked about the Wild West of subprime mortgage brokers. I'm beginning to wonder whether we have a Wild West of unregulated financial instruments, of SIVs and misrated CDOs and other complicated investments whose values are not marked to market or even marked to model, but to quote one Wall Street strategist, are marked to make-believe. To quote you, Mr. Chairman, the markets want to know how much these damn things are worth. And I want to know what all of us, the Federal Reserve, the Congress, and this administration can do, if anything, to assuage those fears. I'm very concerned, Mr. Chairman, that none of the regulators are acting quickly or boldly enough to deal with the risks we're facing. A laissez-faire, hands-off attitude might be appropriate if we had one of these crises, but confronting all of these problems at once should be a call to action because the danger we face is so much greater. I know that Secretary Paulson has organized a super conduit to try to deal with the liquidity crunch faced by SIVs and the threat they pose to the broader financial markets. To be direct, I'm worried this may just be a shell game an attempt to move bad investments around and keep them from landing back on the books? I'll be curious to hear your opinion today, Mr. Chairman, about the Secretary's plan, as well as your views about the risks these complex and opaque pools of capital now present to our financial system and how you intend to deal with them. If you don't feel you have the tools at your disposal to address these problems, then I hope you'll share your views what we in Congress ought to do. I'm glad to see that much of your statement is given over to the importance of helping distressed subprime borrowers. You mentioned some of the efforts my colleagues and I have made, and I won't spend more time on that right now. But I will say it would really be nice if the administration would join us in our attempts to protect families from fallout of the subprime lending disaster. The policy responses from the administration have not come close to matching the magnitude of the crisis. There is a lack of confidence that anyone is in charge. Mr. Chairman, if you feel that in your position you cannot speak publicly about the changes that are needed, I urge you to speak privately to members of the administration. Use your position to jawbone them into action. Your predecessor was not shy about putting his prestige and credibility to work behind the scenes, and I encourage you to do the same. One of the great legacies of the American economy has been its ability to make everyone better off. Throughout most of our history, when our economic pie has gotten bigger, everyone has shared, the nation has prospered, everyone got along. But over the 7 years of this administration, that has not been the case. Even in the recovery of the last few years, the benefits have gone mainly to those at the top. Now, as we face an economic slowdown or worse, I'm very worried it's those Americans who haven't shared in our recent growth who will bear the brunt of economic decline, and that the policies of this administration will only further exacerbate their difficulties. I don't pretend that they're easy solutions to troubling challenges facing our economy. The oil crisis, the falling dollar, they took years in the making and will not be solved with the snap of a finger. But we cannot shy away from those challenges. We cannot for another day or month avoid these problems any longer because the chickens seem to be coming home to roost. And we need your voice, either publicly or privately, to help move us in that direction. I look forward to your testimony on the economic outlook and to an interesting discussion of how we best meet these and other economic challenges we face. Now, normally I encourage all of our members to make opening statements, but because we only have a limited time with Chairman Bernanke, I'm going to ask our Vice Chairman and Senate and the Senate and House ranking members to make opening statements. Other members may submit their full opening statements for the record. And now I turn the committee to the committee's ranking Republican, my colleague on the House side, Congressman Saxton.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. And Chairman Bernanke, I'm pleased to join in welcoming you here again to testify before the Joint Economic Committee, and must say that I appreciate your testimony in the past and look forward to your views on the economic outlook today. I guess each of us must decide whether our glass is half full or half empty. There is good news about the economy, and as the chairman just pointed out, there is troubling indicators that we have to take into consideration as well. According to the standard measures of performance, such as economic growth and the unemployment rate, the U.S. economy, on the one hand, seems to be doing quite well. Real economic growth was 3.9% in the third quarter, while the unemployment rate remained relatively low at 4.7%. That was for the month of October, of course. Exports and consumer spending continued to advance, reflecting the resilience of the U.S. economy, something that I have noted in particular during the most recent several years. The recent pace of economic growth is all the more remarkable given the challenges facing the economy. Residential investment declined at a 20% rate in the third quarter, continuing a longer trend. Housing prices are falling in many areas of the country, and housing inventory levels are on the rise. Oil prices, as we all know, are nearing $100 a barrel, and the dollar is falling. In recent months, it has also become clear that a number of large financial institutions have invested in mortgage securities of dubious quality. Huge write-downs of assets by Citigroup and Merrill Lynch are recent validations of the serious concerns about the value of mortgage-backed securities. Uncertainty about the extent of bad investments related to the subprime and other mortgages has spread, resulting in sharp declines in the valuation of bank stocks. Financial markets have become very volatile, as we have seen, particularly in the last several days. Even though recent economic growth appears to be strong, the combination of declining home building, falling housing prices, spiking oil prices, and financial turmoil risks the continuation of a healthy economic growth. The Fed has acted to reduce the strains on the financial sector and to head off a slowdown in the economy. According to the Blue Chip Consensus, the Federal Reserve forecasts the economy will continue to expand through 2008. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's my opening statement, and I look forward to the testimony.
Vice Chair Maloney.
Thank you very much, Chairman, for holding the hearing, and welcome, Chairman Bernanke. We are all eager to hear your remarks on the economic outlook and what that may mean for monetary policy during these troubling times. Tremendous uncertainty remains about how the subprime fallout and the housing slowdown will infect the broader economy. Calling it a subprime crisis is no longer adequate, as the breadth and depth of this escalating credit crisis roils our major financial institutions almost daily. The seeming inability of our most sophisticated and respected institutions to measure their exposure to these assets, and more importantly, to manage the risks associated with them, poses a serious threat to our financial markets. The chairman of General Motors' recent admission yesterday that he could not tell with any accuracy what the company's exposure is to subprime losses at GMAC is both stunning and frightening. Investors did not understand what they were buying when they held CDOs and CIVs, and now we're seeing billions of dollars in losses on these investments. Risk is coming home to roost with a vengeance. We have yet to see the full impact of these losses on the economy or the labor market. In the near term, forecasters expect the economy to slow as high energy prices and falling home values squeeze consumers, all of which points to a gathering storm that could drag down the economy, taking American jobs with it. The Federal Reserve has worked to prevent the economy from derailing and has eased the credit crunch by lowering its key interest rate. But at their last meeting, the Fed signaled a wait-and-see approach to further actions. With crude oil edging towards $100 a barrel and the dollar sinking like a stone, inflation is certainly a concern for the Fed. The dollar fell sharply again yesterday as the Chinese government signaled a shift away from the purchases of dollars in favor of euros. I think we would all like to hear more from Chairman Bernanke about any contingency plans the Fed has should economic forces move toward a fall. Our tremendous fiscal imbalances, including our record $9 trillion debt, is further complicating the Fed's job of setting the right course for monetary policy. But for the moment, core inflation remains in check, and there is little evidence that the labor market poses any real inflationary risk. Wages have barely kept pace with rising prices, and they have lagged far behind productivity. I hope the chairman will agree that how American families are faring should not take a back seat to fighting inflation. By all accounts, we haven't felt the worst of the housing market slump. Millions of Americans are worried that they can't afford to keep their homes, let alone to heat them this winter. Congress is working very hard to keep people in their homes and prevent another crisis like this from happening again. In the House of Representatives, we have passed a reform legislation to shore up the FHA and the GSEs, and just this week we passed a sweeping mortgage reform and anti-predatory lending legislation in the Financial Services Committee that will head to the floor next week. These are important first steps, and there is a great deal more to do to help restore the American dream for many hardworking families. Mr. Chairman, we look forward forward to gaining some insights into how the Fed will balance the various risks to the economy when setting monetary policy. And again, we welcome you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Maloney and Ranking Member Brownback.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate that. And Chairman Wernicke, pleasure to have you here. American economy has demonstrated, I believe, amazing resilience in the face of a variety of challenges. Witnessed 24 consecutive quarters of positive real economic growth, near 4% growth this last quarter, 50 consecutive months of payroll employment growth, that's the longest on record, significant expansion in our exports, and yet my perception, and I think that of my colleagues up here, is that our economy is at a crossroads. And that's why I think we're all so interested in your testimony here today, and I think the markets are so interested in your testimony. We have had a nice long run, but it looks as if there are some really troubling signs out there. We've all talked about oil prices. We've all talked about the subprime market. I know you're going to address those. One thing certainly seems clear to me on our part as legislators that the idea of raising taxes at this point in time would be a terrible idea and a terrible thing for the economy. If we were either to raise them purposely or to allow them to be raised because we didn't vote to extend the tax cuts that have been put in place, would be the exact wrong signal and the exact wrong thing to do in an economy that is at a crossroads. So from our stance of fiscal policy and what we can do for economic growth on our side, I would certainly hope that, we would set aside all sorts of ideas of that nature and say, no, we're going to cut taxes and we're going to keep them low to try to keep the economy going. On your side of it, I look forward to your comments, what we can do, what you're doing, what we should do in the subprime mortgage markets, and also on the impact of high oil prices on consumer spending. And I do hope that the Fed is considering a further cut in rates to help the economy, to help the American consumer, which is, what, 70% of the economy going into the important Christmas buying season. It seems to me that now's the time, and I know you're weighing this, but I would certainly put my 2 cents worth in rate cuts at this point in time when the consumer is seeing so much direct pressure on their pocketbook. Those gas prices get up to $3 a gallon. It seems to hit some sort of psychological point in the consumer's mind that I have less to spend, and that's a reality for them. I'm going to spend less in other areas. And then that reverberates on through the economy. And so a rate cut could be something very valuable of a signal to send into this economy, to the economy and to the consumer. Much is at stake on our part and on your part. We look forward to your thoughts and your wisdom that you can share with us of what we need to do to navigate through these troubled waters. Delighted you're here. Delighted you're in that job, and I'm not.
Mr. Chairman, please proceed.
Thank you. Chairman Schumer, Vice Chairman Maloney, Representative Saxton, and other members of the committee, thank you for inviting me here this morning to present an update on the economic situation and outlook. Since I last appeared before this committee in March, the U.S. economy has performed reasonably well. On preliminary estimates, real gross domestic product grew at an average pace of nearly 4% over the second and third quarters, despite the ongoing correction in the housing market. Core inflation has improved modestly, although recent increases in energy prices will likely lead overall inflation to rise for a time. However, the economic outlook has been importantly affected by recent developments in financial markets, which have come under significant pressure over the past few months. The financial turmoil was triggered by investor concerns about the credit quality of mortgages, especially subprime mortgages with adjustable interest rates. The continuing increase in the rate of serious delinquencies in such mortgages reflects in part a decline in underwriting standards in recent years, as well as a softening of house prices. Delinquencies on these mortgages are likely to rise further in coming quarters as a sizable number of recent vintage subprime loans experienced their first interest rate resets. I will have more to say about this problem and its implications for homeowners later in my testimony. At one time, most mortgages were originated and held by depository institutions. Today, however, mortgages are commonly bundled together into mortgage-backed securities or structured credit products rated by credit rating agencies, and then sold to investors. As mortgage losses have mounted, investors have questioned the reliability of credit ratings, especially those of structured products. Because many investors had not developed the capacity to perform independent evaluations of these often complex instruments, the loss of confidence in the credit ratings, together with uncertainty about developments in the housing market, led to a sharp decline in the demand for these products. Since July, few securities backed by subprime mortgages have been issued. Although the problems with subprime mortgages initiated the financial turmoil, credit concerns quickly spilled over into a number of other areas. Importantly, the secondary market for securities backed by prime jumbo mortgages also contracted, and the issuance of such securities has declined significantly. Prime jumbo loans are still being made to prospective home purchasers, but they are at higher spreads and have more restrictive terms. Concerns about mortgage-backed securities and structured credit products, even those unrelated to mortgages, also greatly reduced investor appetite for asset-backed commercial paper, although that market has improved somewhat recently. In the area of business credit, investors shied away from financing leveraged buyouts and from purchasing speculative-grade corporate bonds. And some larger banks, concerned about potentially large and difficult-to-predict draws on their liquidity and balance sheet capacity, became less willing to provide funding to their customers and to each other. To be sure, the recent developments may well lead to a healthier financial system in the medium to long term. Increased investor scrutiny of structured credit products is likely to lead ultimately to greater transparency in these products and to better differentiation among assets of varying quality. Investors have also become more cautious and are demanding greater compensation for bearing risk. In the short term, however, these events do imply a greater measure of financial restraint on economic growth as credit becomes more expensive and difficult to obtain. At the height of the recent financial turmoil, the Federal Reserve took a number of steps to help markets return to more orderly functioning. The Fed increased liquidity in short-term money markets in early August through larger-than-normal open market operations. And on August, the Federal Reserve Board cut the discount rate, the rate at which it lends directly to banks, 50 basis points or 1/2 percentage point, and subsequently took several additional measures. These efforts to provide liquidity appear to have been helpful on the whole, but the functioning of a number of important markets remained impaired. The turmoil in financial markets significantly affected the Federal Reserve's outlook for the broader economy. Indeed, in a statement issued simultaneously with the Board's August 17th announcement of the cut in the discount rate, the Federal Open Market Committee noted that the downside risk to economic growth had increased appreciably. The committee took further action at its next scheduled meeting on September 18th when it cut its target for the federal funds rate 50 basis points. This action was intended as a counterbalance to the tightening of credit conditions and to address in a preemptive fashion some of the risks that financial developments pose to the broader economy. The committee met most recently in October 30-31. The data reviewed at that meeting suggested that growth in the third quarter had been solid at a 3.9% rate, according to the initial estimate by the Bureau of Economic Analysis. Residential construction declined sharply during the quarter, as expected, subtracting about 1 percentage point from overall growth. However, the GDP report provided scant evidence of spillovers from housing to other components of final demand. Strong growth in consumer spending was supported by gains in employment and income, and businesses increased their capital spending at a solid pace. A strong global economy stimulated foreign demand for U.S.-produced goods and services, as foreign trade contributed nearly 1 percentage point to the growth of real output last quarter. Looking forward, however, the committee did not see the recent growth performance as likely to be sustained in the near term. Financial conditions had improved somewhat after the September FOMC action, but the market for non-conforming mortgages remained significantly impaired, and survey information suggested that banks had tightened terms and standards for a range of credit products over recent months. In part because of the reduced availability of mortgage credit, the contraction in housing-related activity seemed likely to intensify. Indicators of overall consumer sentiment suggested that household spending would grow more slowly, a reading consistent with the expected effects of higher energy prices, tighter credit, and continuing weakness in housing. most businesses appear to enjoy relatively good access to credit, but heightened uncertainty about economic prospects could lead business spending to decelerate as well. Overall, the committee expected that the growth of economic activity would slow noticeably in the fourth quarter from its third quarter rate. Growth was seen as remaining sluggish during the first part of next year, then strengthening as the effects of tighter credit and the housing correction began to wane. The committee also saw downside risks to this projection. One such risk was that financial market conditions would fail to improve or even worsen, causing credit conditions to become even more restrictive than expected. Another risk was that, in light of the problems in mortgage markets and the large inventories of unsold homes, house prices might weaken more than expected, which could further reduce consumers' willingness to spend and increase investors' concern about mortgage credit. The committee projected overall and core inflation to be in a range consistent with price stability next year. Supporting this view were modest improvements in core inflation over the course of the year, inflation expectations that appeared reasonably well anchored, and futures quotes suggesting that investors saw food and energy prices coming off their recent peaks next year. But the inflation outlook was also seen as subject to important upside risks. In particular, prices of crude oil and other commodities had increased sharply in recent weeks, and the foreign exchange value of the dollar had weakened. These factors were likely to increase overall inflation in the short run, and should inflation expectations become unmoored, had the potential to boost inflation in the longer run as well. Weighing its projections for growth and inflation, as well as the risks to those projections, the FOMC on October 31st reduced its target for the federal funds rate an additional 25 basis points to 4.5%. In the committee's judgment, the cumulative easing of policy over the past 2 months should help forestall some of the adverse effects on the broader economy that might otherwise arise from the disruptions in financial markets and promote moderate growth over time. Nonetheless, the committee recognized that risks remain to both of its statutory objectives of maximum employment and price stability. All told, it was the judgment of the FOMC that after its action on October 31st, the stance of monetary policy roughly balanced the upside risk to inflation and the downside risk to growth. In the days since the October FOMC meeting, the few data releases that have become available have continued to suggest that overall economy activity, remain resilient in recent months. However, financial market volatility and strains have persisted. Incoming information on the performance of mortgage-related assets has intensified investors' concerns about credit market developments and the implications of the downturn in the housing market for economic growth. In addition, further sharp increases in crude oil prices have put renewed upward pressure on inflation, and it may impose further restraint on economic activity. The FOMC will continue to carefully assess the implications for the outlook of the incoming economic data and financial market developments, and will act as needed to foster price stability and sustainable economic growth. I would like to say a few words about actions being taken to help homeowners who have fallen behind on their mortgage payments or seem likely to do so. As I mentioned, delinquencies will probably rise further for borrowers who have a subprime mortgage with an adjustable interest rate, as many of these mortgages will soon see their rates reset at significantly higher levels. Indeed, on average from now until the end of next year, nearly 450,000 subprime mortgages per quarter are scheduled to undergo their first interest rate reset. Relative to past years, avoiding the payment shock of an interest rate reset by refinancing the mortgage will be much more difficult, as home prices have flattened out or declined, thereby reducing homeowners' equity, and lending terms have tightened. Should the rate of foreclosure rise proportionately, communities as well as individual borrowers would be hurt, because concentrations of foreclosures tend to reduce property values in surrounding areas. A sharp increase in foreclosed properties for sale could also weaken the already struggling housing market and thus potentially the broader economy. Home losses through foreclosure can be reduced if financial institutions work with borrowers who are having difficulty meeting their mortgage payment obligations. In recent months, the Federal Reserve and other banking agencies have issued statements calling on mortgage lenders and mortgage servicers to pursue prudent loan workouts. Our contacts with the mortgage industry suggest that servicers recently have stepped up their efforts to work with borrowers facing financial difficulties or an imminent rate reset. Some servicers have been proactive about contacting borrowers who have missed payments or face resets, as experience shows that addressing the problem early increases the odds of a successful outcome. Foreclosure cannot always be avoided, but in many cases, loss mitigation techniques that preserve home ownership are less costly than foreclosure. To help keep borrowers in their homes, servicers have been offering assistance with repayment plans, temporary forbearance, and loan modifications. Comprehensive data on the success of these efforts to avert foreclosures are not available. My sense is that there is scope for servicers to further increase their loss mitigation efforts. The development of standardized approaches to workouts and the sharing of best practices can help increase the scale of the effort, even if ultimately workouts must be undertaken loan by loan. Although workouts are to be encouraged, regulators must be alert to ensure that they are done in ways that protect consumers' interests and do not disguise lenders' losses or impair safety and soundness. The Federal Reserve has been participating in efforts by community groups to help homeowners avoid foreclosure. For example, Governor Krosner of the Federal Reserve Board serves as the director of NeighborWorks America, a nonprofit organization that has been helping thousands of borrowers facing current or potential distress to obtain assistance from their lenders, their servicers, or trusted counselors through a hotline. The Federal Reserve Board staff has been working with consumer and community affairs groups throughout the Federal Reserve system to help identify localities that are most at risk of high foreclosures, with the intent to help local groups better focus their outreach efforts to borrowers. Other contributions include foreclosure prevention programs, such as the Home Ownership Preservation Initiative, which the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago helped to initiate, and efforts by reserve banks to convene workshops for stakeholders to develop community-based solutions to mortgage delinquencies in their areas. The Federal Reserve System is also engaged in research and analysis that should help inform policy responses to these issues. The Congress is also focused on reducing homeowners' risk of foreclosure. One statutory change that could help is the modernization of programs administered by the Federal Housing Administration. The FHA has considerable experience helping low and moderate income households obtain home financing, but it has lost market share in recent years, partly because borrowers have moved toward non-traditional products with more flexible and quicker underwriting and processing, and partly because of a cap on the maximum loan value that can be insured. In modernizing the FHA, the Congress might encourage joint efforts with the private sector that expedite the refinancing of subprime loans held by creditworthy borrowers facing resets. It might also consider granting the agency the flexibility to design products that improve affordability through such features as variable maturities or shared appreciation. Also, the FHA could provide more refinancing options for riskier households if it could tailor the premiums it charges for mortgage insurance to the risk profile of the borrower. As I have discussed in earlier testimony, the Federal Reserve is taking steps to avoid subprime lending problems from recurring while preserving responsible subprime lending. In coordination with other federal supervisory agencies and the Conference of State Banking Supervisors, we have issued principles-based underwriting guidance on subprime mortgages to help ensure that borrowers obtain loans that they can afford to repay and have the opportunity to refinance without prepayment penalty for a reasonable period before the first interest rate reset. In addition, together with the Office of Thrift Supervision, the Federal Trade Commission, the CSBS, and the American Association of Residential Mortgage Regulators, we have launched a pilot program aimed at strengthening reviews of consumer protection compliance at selected non-depository lenders with significant subprime mortgage operations. Finally, using the authority granted us by the Congress under the Home Ownership and Equity Protection Act, we are on schedule to propose rules by the end of this year to address unfair or deceptive mortgage lending practices. These rules would apply to subprime loans offered by any mortgage lender. We are looking closely at practices such as prepayment penalties, failure to escrow for taxes and insurance, stated income and low documentation lending, and failure to give adequate consideration to a borrower's ability to repay. Using our authority under the Truth in Lending Act, or TILA, we expect that we will soon propose rules to curtail abuses in mortgage advertising and to ensure that consumers receive mortgage disclosures at a time when the information is likely to be the most useful to them. We are also engaged in a rigorous, broader review of the TILA rules for mortgage loans, which will make use of extensive consumer testing of disclosures. Thank you. I'd be pleased to answer your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Very much appreciate your comprehensive testimony. And you noted in your statement that you thought there would be slow growth in the next few quarters, but not a recession. You also noted there are downsides that one would have to take into account, and they would be, again, what I call the four horsemen of our economic problems: lower housing prices, higher oil prices, dropping dollar, and lack of confidence in the credit markets. So let me ask you a question. What is a recession out of the question? What is the likelihood we might go into a recession? If I could make it simple, on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being most likely, how likely is a recession?
Mr. Chairman, as you noted, our forecast is for moderate but positive growth going forward for the next few quarters. Economists are extremely bad at predicting turning points, and we don't pretend to be any better. We have not calculated a probability of recession, and I wouldn't want to offer that today. Again, our assessment is for slower growth but positive growth going into next year. We think that by the spring, early next year, that is as these credit problems resolve, and as we hope the housing market begins to find a bottom, that the broader resiliency of the economy, which we are seeing in other areas outside of housing, will take control and will help the economy recover to a more reasonable growth pace.
Thank you. Next, yesterday there was mention by a Chinese official, some gave it more credence than others, that the Chinese might start investing more of their assets, even switching over some of their assets to those in stronger currencies than the dollar. How worried are you about that? How likely is it to occur? How much credibility do you give this statement that was made yesterday?
There is no official government statement in this regard, and I'm not particularly concerned about any major change in the holdings of China or any other country. There is on the margin sovereign wealth funds and portions of reserve accumulations that are being devoted to higher return, which means spreading across instruments as well as across currencies. But again, I don't see any significant change in the broad holdings of dollars around the country, around the world. Dollars remain the dominant reserve asset, and I expect that to continue to be the case. I would like to add, though, that the strength of the dollar in the medium term will ultimately depend not on those portfolio choices so much as on the strength of the U.S. economy, our trade situation, and on the openness of our financial markets to foreign capital. And I'm optimistic on those fronts, and I do believe that that will lead to a sound dollar in the medium term.
Wouldn't it be in the interest of some of these foreign countries in the longer term, not in the immediate term, if the dollar continues to show the weakness it has shown so far, to diversify?
Well, if they're pegging their exchange rate to the dollar, then there's a certain need, but to hold dollars, of course. But I think more broadly that the financial markets in the U.S. are still the deepest, the most liquid, and offer the most range of investment opportunities. And in that respect, you often see, for example, trade between third countries still being invoiced in dollars because it remains a standard of value around the world, and I expect that to continue.
One of the engines of our economic growth, the main engine, has been consumer spending. It's been estimated that a significantly high percentage of that consumer spending was fueled by refinancings of homes, which gave the consumer more money to spend for other things. The decline in housing prices, both because refinancings would decline and because people felt they had less in terms of assets, present a problem for consumer spending. How much do you expect the decline in housing prices to affect consumer spending? And again, if home prices decline further than you expect, would that create a real danger for our economy?
Well, certainly as homeowners see their wealth declining in terms of their house value, that will affect their thinking about long-term their long-term spending opportunities and affect their spending. We do not take a alarmist view on this, however. There are some who feel that consumers react extremely strongly to changes, for example, in home equity line availability. Our sense is that the relationship between home wealth and consumer spending is governed primarily by what's called the wealth effect, which suggests that for each dollar that a house value falls, there's a net effect on consumer spending of somewhere between 4 and 9 cents, something like that. So there is, and that effect may be spread over a period of time. So there would be an effect, but we see it as a relatively moderate. But there, as you point out correctly, there are a number of factors at play right now, and including high oil prices, for example, that would be negatives for consumer spending. On the other hand, to the extent the labor market has remained reasonably strong and employment income has continued to grow, that is a positive to help sustain the consumer.
One final question. Federal Reserve Governor Krosner recently suggested that mortgage investors and servicers modify subprime mortgages en masse rather than on a case-by-case basis because it's just so hard. There are so few people on the ground. These are complicated instruments these days. What is your view of doing that? I know that the Federal Reserve, you said you were going to issue some guidance to lenders on rules-based standardized loan modifications. Could you comment on how seriously the Fed would take Governor Krosner's idea and what you're doing about it?
We take it seriously. I mentioned in my testimony the need to begin to scale up these efforts as resets become imminent. So we are looking, for example, at we're already talking with servicers who are developing either computer programs or templates or procedures that allow them, at least as a first cut, to categorize mortgages in terms of you know, how they are to be treated. That, on the one hand, will help the help them scale up their efforts, and we believe that's beginning to happen, and we encourage that to happen. And in addition, by providing a systematic approach to addressing these mortgages, they actually protect themselves against claims by investors or others who feel that they are arbitrarily changing or modifying the loans. So we do support scaling up these efforts, and the best way to do that is by creating some more systematic approaches to doing so.
Okay. Thank you, Congressman Saxton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me ask, as I sat here this morning to observe the information flow back and forth, we've talked about a number of issues, some of which are positive and some of which are not so positive. For example, on the positive side, it's good news that core inflation and the numbers that we look at to study core inflation lead us to think that inflation, at least core inflation, seems to be pretty much in check. On the other hand, we've talked about construction, particularly housing construction, being in not such good shape. You just mentioned that the house price decline has a wealth effect, which has implications going forward. The financial condition of large banks has been discussed here at some length this morning, and that certainly going forward again has cause for some concern relative to economic growth. And of course, the potential effect of $100 a barrel or thereabouts oil has implications going forward as well. Now, I noted from the FOMC statement last week, it suggested at least to some that the markets, to some in the markets, that Fed monetary policy stance was becoming, quote, more neutral. Given that core inflation seems to be in check and given that there are concerns going forward with the economy, could you give us your view of what perhaps more neutral monetary policy means?
Yes, Congressman. The as we said in our statement, we feel that the risks in terms of what could go wrong in both directions have become more balanced since we've taken 75 basis points of cuts in the last two meetings to try to offset, you know, the tightening in credit that we've seen. On the inflation side, it's true that there's some positives. Core inflation has been lower. We believe that inflation expectations remain reasonably stabilized. That being said, Congresswoman Maloney mentioned oil prices and the declining dollar, which may have some effect on import prices. Those are risks that we cannot ignore. Should inflation expectations begin to move up and inflation begin to rise, it would be very costly for us to have to bring that back down. And so that's a concern we have, and we need to pay attention to inflation. It's very important that we do so. On the output side, again, we do expect some slowing relating to a variety of factors, including tightening credit conditions and the slowing in the housing market. But as you mentioned yourself, the broader economy outside of housing has been remarkably resilient over the last couple of years. We had 4% growth in the third quarter, even with a percentage point subtracted through housing, and the numbers we've seen in the last week or two have not really changed the view that so far, at least, the spillovers from housing to the broader economy have been limited. Now, having said all that, there's a lot of uncertainties. The financial market turmoil creates a good deal of uncertainty, how that's going to evolve. The housing market creates uncertainty. The dollar and oil prices are sources of uncertainty. And so our view is that we have a mandate to fulfill, and that mandate is to ensure price stability and maximum employment. And we will be very dependent on the data. We will be observing what data comes in. We'll be looking at conditions in financial markets, and we'll be trying to continuously update our views on how the economy is likely to evolve, and we're certainly going to respond as we see those risks change in one direction or another. We certainly want to be able to respond as needed to meet our mandate.
Thank you. On the housing spillover, I've been curious about this because I've been watching the same or many of the same numbers that you have. You would think that with construction being down, and you would think other sectors of the economy would be directly affected, major appliances, hardware of various kinds, the lumber industry, obviously, and other related sectors of the economy that provide products that are used in the home construction business, as well as other related sectors of the economy. Do you have any idea why it is that this spillover effect does not seem to be evident?
Congressman, we do see the spillover in the areas that you mentioned. For example, the Detroit automakers are seeing declines in their sales of pickup trucks because of the declines in construction activity. And certainly companies making appliances and home furnishings and so on have seen activity decline. And in general, manufacturing activity has slowed and looks at this point to be growing very, very slowly. And that in part reflects the relationship between manufacturing and housing, which is only partly offset by exports. But in general, I think there's two factors that have kept the economy growing. One is that the labor market has remained reasonably strong, and with a reasonably good availability of jobs and income growth, consumers have continued to spend. And a second factor, which is going to support the economy going forward, is that the global economy is also very strong, and demand for U.S. production and exports has helped buoy our economy. So for the first time this last year and year and a half or so, for the first time in many years, the trade sector has been a positive contribution to the U.S. growth as opposed to a negative contribution. And I think going forward we'll see additional strength coming from foreign trade.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Vice Chair Maloney.
Thank you very much for your testimony and insights today. I am really stunned by the lack of understanding by investors and major sophisticated institutions in CIBs and CDOs. They seem not to have understood the risk. We are seeing a major losses at major institutions. And my question is, does the Fed, I certainly hope the Fed, has a better understanding or sense of what's in these CDOs and CIBs than the investors?
Well, the problems emerged some time ago when the subprime losses began to appear, and some of these mortgage-backed securities and other types of instruments that had mortgages, even though they were technically rated AAA, began to show losses, and suddenly the confidence was lost, and investors became unwilling to buy these instruments. In retrospect, it's surprising and disappointing that, as you say, sophisticated investors essentially looked at the credit rating, and that's all they did. They didn't do due diligence. They didn't investigate what was in the CDO, for example, in any detail.
Has the Fed investigated what's in?
Well, the Fed is of course working with the other regulators, the SEC, the accounting board, and so on, to make sure that these off balance sheet instruments and the bank balance sheets themselves are being written down appropriately, so that they reflect the actual values. And so we are working with the banks, the ones who sponsor these off-balance sheet instruments, to make sure that that they are getting true valuations. It's a little bit of a moving target, because as time passes, if we see worse, ratings downgrades, for example, some of the assets have to be revalued again. But it's very much in the interest of the banks to disclose as much as possible and to write down their losses, and we along with the other regulators are paying close attention to that marking process.
It seems that the CDOs are so opaque in their risk and composition that trading in them only works in a rising market, and I have seen your actions in this area, and I wonder, why has the Fed been more insistent on major improvements in transparency as a condition of the government's willingness to participate and basically propping up these markets? As you know, when government came in and worked with long-term capital markets in 1998, we demanded a risk management best practices came out of it. Treasury demanded basic improvements in the bailout in Mexico. And why aren't we coming out, or why isn't the Fed coming out with specific, best practices or goals to force the transparency in this area that everyone seems to not understand basically what they're buying or the value?
Well, first, Congresswoman, we're not bailing out anybody. We haven't put a penny of our money or federal money into the banks or into the CDOs. What we are doing is exercising our responsibility to make sure that the banks disclose the information and that they value these things properly. It's not our practice in the broad financial world to protect investors, particularly sophisticated investors who should be able to make their own evaluations, from buying individual instruments. What our responsibility is to make sure that the banks are safe and sound, and that they are appropriately valuing their balance sheets, and that their exposures to these off-balance sheet instruments are appropriately measured and accounted for, particularly with respect to capital. So that's what we're focused on. We've been focused on it for some time, and as we move forward into Basel II and into other changes we're making, it's certainly going to be something that we're going to be looking at very closely.
Last week, former Secretary Rubin said that a weak dollar is bad for the U.S. economy. And do you agree with him that a strong dollar increases Americans' standard of living and keeps inflation low? Or do you think, as some economists argue, that we can devalue our way to prosperity, allow the dollar to weaken to boost exports, help close the trade deficit, and create better jobs?
Well, again, the Secretary of the Treasury is the spokesperson for official policy. We are looking at the dollar primarily as it affects the U.S. economy, and one of the concerns.
Then maybe let me say it in a different way. Do you think that the decline in the dollar will lead to inflation and higher long-term interest rates?
The decline of the dollar has the potential to raise import prices and contribute to inflation, and therefore we are very attentive to that risk. In all but the shortest of terms, the Federal Reserve's policy determines how much inflation there is, and we're going to make sure that the inflationary impact that may come from the weakening dollar is not passed into broader prices and become part of the underlying inflation rate.
Thank you. My time is up.
Senator Brownback.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chairman Bernanke, On page 6 of your testimony, you talked about that you're going to continue to look at the need to foster price stability and sustainable economic growth. And I want to make sure I'm clear with you on this. Do you consider either of these as the greater threat at this point in time, or that these are roughly kind of equal threats, price stability or inflation and economic growth?
We assess the risks to those objectives as being roughly balanced at this time. There are risks on both sides of the mandate. As we go forward, however, we are not dogmatic. We are going to go forward. We're going to follow the data. We're going to see what's happening in financial markets, and we'll try to make judgments over time as we get new information.
And even as oil prices go to $100 a barrel, $3 at the gas pump, you look at those as particularly equal, because I look at gas prices, and that's directly out of a consumer's pocketbook. That's a direct hit. And they go into the Christmas season, they're seeing, I'm having to pay a lot more at the pump. It seems to really, I think, affect the mentality when you get at that $3 a gallon gas or above, as it is in many places around the country.
Senator, you're absolutely right that this is a big burden for the U.S. economy, although we've been pretty resilient so far in dealing with higher oil prices. But I would just point out that while it has its effects on consumer spending, it's obviously also an inflation risk, both because gasoline prices are part of the consumer's basket and therefore part of inflation. And even more concerning would be if those gas prices were to feed through into other costs and lead to a broader rise in prices. And so we have to be very vigilant to make sure that higher oil prices don't translate into broader inflation in the economy.
Not as the Fed chairman, but as an economist, raising taxes at this point in time, not dealing with the alternative minimum tax problem that's grabbing more people, or allowing a raising of taxes on dividends or capital, what sort of impact would that have on the economy at this point in time?
Well, Senator, I'm not going to comment on specific individual proposals. I do think that a net gain and a net increase in taxes that was substantial would probably not be advisable because of its effect on aggregate demand, but it's a complex issue on each of these tax areas that you're mentioning. To talk about the pros and the cons, we can pursue that if you like, but I prefer not to take a position on one side or the other of these individual tax proposals.
Still, as an overall item in the economy at this point in time, where you have an economy that is concerning, to raise taxes now would not be advisable for its impact on long-term economic growth in the economy.
A large increase in net taxes would tend to be a drag on consumer spending and on the economy through a number of different channels, I should say. And that would be an issue, I think, if that were to be the case, given what we expect to be a slower growth economy for the next couple of quarters.
I want to look at the impact of China on the U.S. economy. You must be watching that very closely, their purchasing or their use of dollar denominations, inflationary impact coming from consumer products coming out of China into the U.S. economy, or the concern we have of consumer products coming in China. What are the lead factors you're watching in the Chinese economy for as far as its impact into the U.S.?
Well, the main thing we'd like to see in China is a rebalancing of the economy away from this very strong dependence on exports, which contributes to global imbalances and to the U.S. external deficit, towards a more domestically driven economy. So particularly in China, this is a rather remarkable statistic, but the average, the national saving rate in China is close to 50%,
wow.
Given even though as poor a country as it is, which means that even though they have very high capital investment, in order to sustain growth, they have to export, and they have a current account surplus now that's in the order of 9 to 10% of GDP. They need to reorient their growth towards domestic needs. They do need to do that by strengthening consumer spending and by reducing the emphasis on exports. And I gave a speech some time ago talking about some of the ways they could do that, for example, by strengthening the social safety net so people didn't have to save so much in anticipation of being sick or retiring. In addition, as we've talked often and as Senator Schumer has often emphasized, They need to increase the flexibility of their exchange rate in order to allow for the natural process of demand to shift away from a totally export-oriented economy more to a balanced, domestically-oriented economy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bingaman.
Thank you very much. Is this working, I guess? Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for being here. Let me ask about the secondary market for mortgages. My impression is that the ability of an individual to borrow from a bank ultimately depends upon the ability of that bank to turn around and sell that mortgage into a secondary market of some kind or have it. That seems to me to be the place where the system is breaking down or has broken down, and over the next 6 months or so, that's the place where the greatest danger lies, is that if banks are not able to sell into a secondary market, credit continues to get constricted and limited. Would you give any thoughts as to how to fix that problem?
Well, I agree with you that one of the largest factors that leads us to think the economy is going to slow somewhat is precisely that issue, that mortgage availability has declined significantly. That's affecting demand for housing in the housing sector and it's feeding over into the broader economy. Some of this is probably inevitable in the sense that we've seen a significant tightening of lending standards in the subprime area, which is understandable given the problems in that area. But we're also seeing, for example, problems of banks securitizing prime jumbo mortgage loans, that is, mortgage loans that are greater than $417,000. That doesn't mean those loans aren't being made. Many banks are making them and keeping them on their balance sheet, and there is some securitization activity going on, and it's limited. And the result is that those mortgages are still available, but at somewhat tighter terms and higher prices than otherwise. I think over time that market's going to improve. I'm not sure what an immediate fix would be. There's been some discussion of raising the conforming loan limit on GSEs. If we do that, I think it ought to be a very temporary measure and be done in a way that assures us that doing so doesn't risk the underlying safety and soundness of those institutions.
But you think a temporary increase of that $417,000 limit would make some sense?
Well, one suggestion I would have, again, it's very important that we not override the regulator's view that the safety and soundness of these institutions must be protected. So one possibility would be if the federal government were willing to act as guarantor. For example, suppose that the GSEs were to pay their usual mortgage insurance credit fee to the federal government, which then acted as guarantor, so to take away the credit risk from the GSEs, then they could process these jumbo loans and sell them to the secondary market, and that would be, I think, of some assistance to the mortgage market. From the federal government's point of view, they would be taking on some credit risk, which you may or may not be willing to do. I think that if you did that, it would be a good idea to make the GSEs ultimately responsible for any excess losses or some part of excess losses relative to the premiums that are paid, and leave it to the regulator to determine when the safety and soundness was adequate that the GSEs could make that repayment. So I think there might be some mechanisms that involved federal interaction, but I think it's extremely important as we look at these options that we don't take actions that will endanger the safety and soundness of the underlying institutions.
Just to follow up on that suggestion that you made there about the federal government taking on this risk, we would have to legislate to do that.
Yes.
Is the legislation pending in the House? Have you reviewed that as to whether that accomplishes what you're suggesting or
not? I'm not aware that it does. the legislation in the House is mostly about dealing with those who are in trouble, borrowers already in trouble, and prospectively the rules for avoiding future abuses. There's not, to my knowledge, Senator Schumer can correct me, not been, to my knowledge, a lot of effort devoted towards the secondary markets.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Senator Sununu.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I'll begin my questioning with an issue related to the one Senator Bingaman was talking about, but is frankly a little bit more negative in its perspective, and that is noting that yesterday the Dow dropped 360 points and observing a number of analysts in the financial press that blamed a lot of that drop on the New York Attorney General in his press release that alleged, in his words, quote, systemic fraud and, quote, a pattern of collusion in the mortgage industry. And he made those allegations with specific reference to transactions between Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and Washington Mutual, for which he issued subpoenas. My question to you is, in this environment where we see big problems with credit in the mortgage industry, is this kind of a press release really helpful to solving the problems in front of us?
Senator, I don't want to intervene in the Attorney General's decisions about what cases to pursue, and I would add that the Federal Reserve has no regulatory authority over any of those institutions. I think what's upsetting the stock market is it's primarily financial stocks that have been falling, and the concern is that that financial firms have not, in the view of the stock market, perhaps have not completely written down the losses that they've suffered from.
And I will be happy to address transparency, and I'm not asking you to comment on whether or not someone is guilty or not guilty, but I'm trying to identify whether or not this will help us address the problems that exist in the industry.
I don't want to intervene in the Attorney General's decisions.
If you don't want to comment on it, that's fine. But, you know, obviously, again, I want to understand what's helpful and what isn't. You mentioned the transparency, though, and the marking to market. This is something else that I'd like to talk about, and apparently you'd like to talk about it more than my first question, so we'll be happy to move there. The Treasury announced a super SIV, a large enhanced liquidity vehicle to try to deal with liquidity issues in structured investment vehicles that are held, probably 30 of them, mostly held by very large institutions. You point out transparency is essential. The process of price discovery is essential to working through these problems. My question here is, what, in your opinion, is the purpose of this enhanced liquidity vehicle, and what will its impact on price discovery be? There is a federal official quoted in the Wall Street Journal that said that this proposal, quote, has the potential to contribute rather than to impair improvements in these markets in the process of price discovery. Well, I would maintain that it's just as true to say this vehicle has the potential to impair rather to contribute to the markets in the process of price discovery. What's the purpose of the vehicle, and what impact do you think it will have on price discovery?
Well, Senator, it all depends on the execution, as I'm sure you would agree. My understanding of the idea behind it is that that a consortium of banks together with investors, major investors, would oversee the process of purchasing high-quality assets from these unwinding sieves, and then create a new vehicle, which would then be financed by commercial paper, you know, purchased by, for example, large mutual funds, for example. So my understanding of the process is that because investors, as well as a number of banks, would be involved essentially as gatekeepers in bringing assets into this new vehicle, that the valuations, there would be an incentive, particularly in part of the investors, but also in terms of banks who didn't have direct exposures, there would be an incentive to create accurate market pricing. If that is the way it works, and again, it depends on the execution, but if that's the way it works, it would remove some overhang from the market, it would create a stable financing source for those assets, and it ought not to be inconsistent with the price discovery process.
I would only observe the operative phrase of that you used regarding participation of investment firms that don't have exposure in these areas. And if you look at the list of firms that were most excited about participating, they all have significant exposure in these investment areas. When you were here last, which is 7 months ago, and the last question I asked, I explained, maybe clearly, maybe not so clearly, why I believed that if you looked at the aggregate down payment available in our economy from consumers on homes and looked at changes in credit underwriting standards, that it was very likely that this year home inventories of unsold homes would increase from the level back in March at approximately 6 months to 8 to 10 months. I asked you, just taking from the transcript, what do you think the impact on demand or the economic level of activity would be if housing inventories were at 8 to 10 months as opposed to today's 6 months? And you responded, if they were at that level, and I do not expect that they will be, then construction will fall further. Now, I'm sure I'll never have the opportunity to say at any other time that I was right and you were wrong. Maybe it was just a lucky guess, but I think we looked at changes in credit and we looked at what was available for down payment. It's just highly likely that inventories would go at least to those levels. I think, without going into a detailed explanation, that there's a very good chance over the next 12 months, inventories will go to at least 12 months and probably to 14 months. What would be the impact on the economy? In specific terms of an increase in housing inventories to 14 months, and what is the best estimate or the best forecast of those at the Fed looking at the housing industry today?
Well, Senator, you were right and I was wrong.
No, I didn't ask you to say that by any means.
The inventories have risen and they produce a great deal of pressure, downward pressure on construction, and to get to where you're describing, would we require further declines in demand, slower responses by home builders, and it would suggest even a greater disequilibrium and a longer period of workout that would subtract directly from economic growth and would increase the hazard of spillovers into other parts of the economy. So that's a concern. Our anticipation, and it depends very much on both the home builder's response and the buyer's response, is that those inventories are not going to go much further from here, but in 6 months you can tell me that I was wrong again, but
I will not look forward to that.
We believe that this process, although we're now under 1 million single-family homes from a peak of 1.7 million and so on, we've really greatly reduced the rate of home construction. And so, in some sense, we think that there's a minimum because there's a certain amount of family formation and so on that's going to support a certain amount of building. So we don't expect it to get to the point you suggest, but again, perhaps you're a better forecaster.
Congressman Cummings.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Chairman, thank you for being with us. Many members of Congress now, Chairman, are holding forums in their districts, as I will be doing very shortly, to help people who are coming to our doors literally with tears in their eyes and trying to figure out how they're going to manage a foreclosure that's right around the corner, and who have been harmed by this, what they thought was going to be a dream, turning into a nightmare. And, as I sat here and I listened to you, and I it seems like you have painted a very rosy picture, but if you came and walked through my district, I think people would be they would be surprised that you seem so calm. Let me ask you a broad question on how we make economic decisions. Why did anyone think that the housing market would not suffer tremendous losses, particularly given the extent of subprime lending extended to those with poor credit, and also given the obvious risks associated with the increases which could certainly be expected in monthly payments due from those with adjustable rate mortgages and certain non-traditional loan packages. Given the extent of the declines that have occurred, do you think that our markets are adequately regulated?
Congressman, first, I don't know how you got the impression that I was unconcerned about foreclosures.
I didn't say that you were unconcerned. I just said you seem to be pretty calm about it. Well, and I guess what I'm trying to make sure is that there's a connection. I notice so often what happens is that when we're making decisions in the suites, we forget about the people who actually have to go through this. But we in Congress, and I sitting in the inner city of Baltimore, look at my constituents who are seeing, who are losing their houses, who are seeing their values go down. They saw, I think, something like 1,200 foreclosures in January, now 7,000 just recently in a month. I mean, things are, we're becoming a bit alarmed. And, you know, I guess I'm just trying to figure out exactly how you talked a little bit earlier about efforts on the part of the companies to fix mortgages and whatever, to help people get fixed rates and whatever. And I just want to know, I want from you every single thing that you can possibly do to help us help our constituents. Because I was just telling Mr. Henchy on the way over, when a person loses their house, it's not just their loss. It's a family's loss. And their dream, the dream that they thought that they had that captured, suddenly disappears out of their hand. And children look at that and they say, well, gee, you know, I don't know whether I'm going to try to buy a house. But more directly, I don't know when they get back to buying a house. That's the problem. So, and many of them, I'm sure, will go a lifetime and never be able to buy a house. And again, we're talking about this economy that we want to keep strong and whatever. But what we're also doing that we don't talk about are the people that we are literally taking out of the market.
Congressman, I spent about half my testimony talking about this problem. I think it's a very serious problem. I think it hurts people. I think it hurts communities. I discussed a number of the actions that companies are taking, and I would urge, first of all, that people in trouble get in contact very early with their servicer or their lender, because the earlier you get in touch, the better chance there is to work something out. I urged the lenders and the servicers to expand their efforts to try to restructure mortgages and help people stay in their homes. I think it's very important. I talked about the Federal Reserve's efforts to try to work with community groups to try and assist that process. And I also talked about our regulatory actions that we're taking to try and make sure it doesn't happen again. So it is a very important problem, and we've spent a lot of time. We've been meeting with people. I met a few days ago with Reverend Jesse Jackson to talk about some of these issues. We have been spending a lot of time on this issue, and we think it's a very, very important issue, which we are going to do everything we can to ameliorate.
And those efforts on the part of those companies have to be pretty much voluntary?
We have to try and give them guidance to show them how best to approach this problem, and we think it's in their interest. Because nobody's interest, if a creditworthy borrower loses their home, that's not in anybody's interest. So we want to try to make sure that they have the flexibility and the leeways needed to restructure loans for people who should be in the home, who have the credit to be in the home.
A little earlier, you stated that the patchwork nature of enforcement authority in subprime lending poses a special challenge. Can you discuss what should be done to improve enforcement of provisions intended to protect consumers from subprime loans?
Well, enforcement is an issue. We are working, as I mentioned, on a set of regulations that would apply to all lenders. And so that would be a new set of rules that would apply to all lenders, including those outside of the federal safety net. The question is enforcement. The states are typically in charge of overseeing the non-federally regulated lenders. Some of them are very, very good at doing that, but we think there's probably more we can do at the Federal Reserve to work with them, to coordinate with them. We have right now going on a pilot program where we are working with other agencies and with the states to try to compare our approaches to supervision and oversight for mortgage lenders, to see what we can learn from each other and to try to increase our coordination with them to try to make them as effective as possible and try and give us as close a relationship to them as possible.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Congressman Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The best way I could describe the problems that we face here in this country, as well as the problem that the Federal Reserve faces, is that we're indeed between the rock and the hard place, because we have a serious problem. We don't talk about much how we got here. We talk about how we're going to patch it up. The bubble has been burst. We saw what happened after the NASDAQ bubble burst. We don't ask how it was created, and then we have a housing bubble, and it's deflating and then it's spreading. And yet nobody says, where does it come from? And what is the advice that you generally get? And that is, inflate the currency. They don't say inflate the currency. They don't say debase the currency. They don't say devalue the currency. They don't say cheat the people who are saved. They say lower the interest rates. But they never ask you, and I don't hear you say too often, the only way I can lower interest rates is I have to create more money. I have to lower the discount rate. I have to make it generous. I have to increase reserves. I have to lower the interest rates and fix the interest rates, overnight rates. And the only way you can do this is by increasing the money supply. And I see this as the problem that we don't want to talk about. Currently, of course, we can't follow the money supply with M3, but we can follow one of your statistics, which is the MZM, the ready cash available, and we see that inflation is alive and well. It's that money supply figure is going up about 20% per annualized. And this just means that the dollar gets weaker. And everybody said, well, the dollar is, that's great. Dollar weaker, we're going to have exports. And that is a fallacy, maybe for a month or two, but it just invites inflation. And unless we get down to the bottom of it and define what inflation is, and not look at only prices, this was taught by the free market economists all through the 20th century. They said, beware. They will increase the money supply, but they will make you concentrate on prices. And they will give you CPIs and PPIs, and they'll fudge those figures, and they'll talk about wage and price controls to solve our problems. And we ignore the fundamental flaw, and that is that not only have we had a subprime market in housing, the whole economic system is subprime in that we have artificially low interest rates. And it wasn't under your tenure in office. It's been going on for 10 years or longer, and now we're bearing the fruits of that that policy. I mean, a 1% interest rate, overnight rates, and that's not a distortion. Instead of looking at these the consumer prices, which nobody in this country really believes, we need to talk about the distortion, the malinvestment, the misdirection, the bad information that is gotten from artificially low interest rates. In many ways, some people refer to you as a price fixer, you know, because you fix interest rates. The market is powerful and usually overwhelms and does come into play, but when the Fed fixes an interest rate at 1%, that is price fixing. At the end of your testimony, you suggested that we should address this housing crisis and we should have rules that would address deceptive lending practices. And I just think that is not the answer at all. The real deception is when we distort the value of money, when we create money out of thin air. We have no savings, and yet there's so-called capital, there's money available, but it comes from what you have to do, and the pressure is put on you. So I think we have to get back to the very fundamentals of where this problem comes from. And the bubbles occur when we have this malinvestment and the creation of new money. So my question boils down to this: how in the world can we expect to solve the problems of inflation, that is, the increase in the supply of money, with more inflation?
Well, Congressman, first, just a small technical point on the growth in money. Money growth has been pretty moderate over the last few years. The increase in MZM is probably related to the financial turmoil. People have been taking their savings out of, you know, risky assets, putting them into the bank, and that makes the money data show faster growth. So I'm not sure that's indicative of policy necessarily. What we're trying to do is follow the mandate that Congress gave us, and the mandate that Congress gave us is to look at employment and inflation as measured by domestic price growth. And as I talked about today, and I think you would agree that we do see risk to inflation, and we are taking those into account, and we want to make sure that prices remain as stable as possible in the United States.
But how can you do this and pursue this, the policy you have, without further weakening the dollar? There's a dollar crisis out there, and people's money is being stolen. People who have saved, they're being robbed. I mean, if you have a devaluation of the dollar at 10%, people have been robbed of 10%. But how can you pursue this policy without addressing the subject that somebody's losing their wealth because of a weaker dollar, and it's going to lead to higher interest rates and a weaker economy?
If somebody has their wealth in dollars and they're going to buy consumer goods in dollars, and it's a typical American, then the decline in the dollar, the only effect it has on their buying power is it makes imported goods more expensive.
Yeah, but not if you're retired and elderly and you have CDs and their cost of living is going up no matter what your CPI says. Their cost of living is going up and they're hurting, and that's why the people in this country are very upset.
Well, we have a certain level of anxiety up here, Mr. Chairman, because there are votes pending shortly in both houses. So I'm going to go briefly, and then we'll try to keep it fast as possible. First of all, let me express my appreciation to you for all the good work you do and of course, for being here with us today. The Federal Reserve has a dual mandate from the Congress. One is to hold down inflation, make sure it doesn't impede upon the economy, and the other is to promote economic growth and to maintain, sustain strong employment figures, good jobs for people as much as possible. It seems to me that right now you're facing a very complex set of conflicting circumstances on both ends, and I think that it's going to be a real challenge to deal with this. Not just from your point of view, but from our point of view, because I think in a variety of ways, obviously, we're all limited in what we can do, and I think that the mandate of the Federal Reserve is specific, and I think that you've done just about all you can do. There will probably be some pressure to lower interest rates again, but the fact is, if those interest rates continue to go down, then the inflation issue is going to be continued to jacked up. We're right now facing an inflationary situation which is increasing. Estimates are that it could go up as high as 2% over the course of the next year, maybe even higher than that. And in the context, I think we have to realize that in that core inflation, we're not including the two most inflationary aspects of this economy, the cost of energy, particularly oil, and the price of food, both of which are rising dramatically. And if that continues, then the pressure on inflation obviously is going to be much, much higher. We're also confronting a situation of a declining economy. This economy is not doing well. And the example of the mortgage closures on 2 million people, maybe a lot more than that as time goes on, is really not the cause of the economic problem we're facing, but it's just a factor of it. It's a factor of the weakness of this economy. And the idea that we're facing, or the question we're facing, is how are we going to deal with this? You've got the dollar, which is now depressed to record lows. And there's every indication that that is likely to continue unless something is done to try to address it. And the major problem with the dollar being driven to record lows is the deep debt that this economy is in, both from the federal point of view and from people's personal points of view. The federal debt now is up above $9 trillion. It's risen by more than $4 trillion over the course of this administration. And all across the country, people are spending nearly 10% more month by month by month, more than what they're making. So the increasing personal debt is going up rapidly. Obviously, that can't be sustained. And that is, in fact, what is sustaining whatever growth we're experiencing in this economy. And then people are talking about how the job rate is good. But the fact of the matter is the job rate isn't good. One of the things that are not being considered in the context of the unemployment rate is the number of people who have dropped out of the economy once again. Dropped out of the job market. They're not seeking jobs. So the unemployment rate is not 4.7. If you bring those people in, it brings it up well up above 5%, maybe as high as 5.5%. So all of these factors are crunching in on us. And it reminds me of a period that we faced a couple of decades ago, which was phrased stagflation, when you had increasing inflation and a downturn in the economy, which is essentially what we're confronting today. We have the lowest job growth rate in America today over the course of the last 6 years, the lowest job growth rate that we've seen since the Depression. So I think that we deeply depend upon you to give us some advice. What is this economy going, what is this Congress going to do, rather, to try to deal with this economy? When we look at the Federal Reserve struggling with it, and we see that there's a limitation on what you can do with regard to interest rates, which is your primary factor of trying to drive the economy and its growth.
Well, you're certainly correct that there's a delicate balance here between the risks on both sides of the mandate, and we're going to do the best we can to assess that. I think the area where the Congress has the most influence is on fiscal policy, obviously, and making wise decisions about spending that will promote growth, that support infrastructure, education, those sorts of things is very important, as is having a rational and sensible tax policy. I would like to be more specific than that, but I think that's really the area where Congress is most can be most effective. In addition, I suggested today that there might be steps the Congress could take to try and ameliorate the foreclosure issue that you mentioned, and Federal Home Administration, the Housing Administration is one potential vehicle, but there may be others. So I do think there are things that can be done, but I guess I should also say that while we do expect slower growth and we do see some risk to inflation, fortunately, we don't see anything approaching the period of the 1970s, and we think growth will be more moderate and inflation has some risks to it, but we do think that the performance will be much better than that period.
Well, I hope your optimism on that has some validity, because I would hate to see it go in the opposite direction, but we are teetering right now in a very, very difficult set of circumstances, and I'm very pleased to hear you talk about how this Congress should be focusing more and more attention and more resources on things like education and health care and building up the basic infrastructure. We're now spending $2 billion a month in Iraq on a war which was justified under completely falsified premises. So this Congress, you're right, Mr. Chairman, has got to refocus its attention and begin to deal with the basic aspects of this economy and deal with the situation in the Middle East much more constructively than we have. Because I think that what you have done in with the interest rate situation has sustained things for a longer period of time than it would have, but I think that time is just about on the edge of running out, and I'm really concerned about what's going to happen now over the course of the next few years. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Bennett.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairman. First, just a personal observation. When I first came to the Senate 15 years ago and attended these meetings, the drumbeat that I heard over and over again was, we're not making enough credit available to the poor. We were coming out of the savings and loan crisis, and in response to that crisis, financial institutions were bringing down the basis on which they would make loans in order to keep themselves from the bankruptcies that occurred with the savings and loan crisis. And the argument from Congress was, you are far too restrictive in your requirements as to who can get money. And you should loosen up. You should make credit available to the poor. You're failing your social responsibility for not making credit to the poor. And now I find it interesting that we find the you've made too much credit available to the poor. And it's your responsibility, you financial institutions. I do not in any way condone those financial institutions that have played fast and loose with the rules. And they're the ones that are paying the biggest price with this meltdown, and they should. But we should remember that in this circumstance, Many people have acquired homes that would not otherwise have homes. And if we can figure out a way to keep them in their homes, the better off we will be and the better off they will be. And recognize that many of those borrowers who are getting hurt falsified their income statements, and others were speculators who were flipping properties, had no intention of living in them. They were participating in the bubble and betting on tulip time, betting that some greater fool would come buy the house at a higher price than they paid, and they lost their bet, and they deserve what they got. Fundamental question, picking up a little bit on what Senator Sununu was saying, we've heard forecasts as to how long it will take for this to work itself out, and it will work itself out. Markets make better decisions than governments do, and the market will punish, the market will reward, and the market will ultimately stabilize. I remember forecasts that it would work itself out in about 6 to 8 months. Give me your forecast now. That clearly is not right, and I don't know whether you made it or whether I made it or whatever, and that doesn't matter. Look into your crystal ball. Is it going to take a year? Is it going to be the end of 2008 before the market has sorted this all out? Do you think that's too pessimistic or too optimistic? What's your sense?
Senator, first, the reason that many forecasters, including the Federal Reserve, have understated the amount of time it would take for this to resolve has been because we've continued to get bad news on subprime lending and the implications of that for housing demand. We saw that in the spring, and we've seen it now more recently, and these things have led us to extend the period of adjustment. From our perspective, we're asking ourselves, when will housing construction stabilize, even at a low level,
right,
so that it no longer subtracts from growth, you know, a percentage point as it has been? That doesn't mean that it's going to be recovered to where it was or that,
yeah,
you know, anything like that. So at the risk of, you know, being proved wrong again and having new credit crunch and other factors delaying even further, you know, our current calculation is that things will begin to flatten out sort of in the second quarter of next year. So it's still, I guess, 6 months. That's of course very provisional, and one of the things we look at very carefully as the data come in, or, you know, what's happening to permits and starts and mortgage applications and the like, and we continue to adjust our forecast according to that.
You're more optimistic than some of the other economists I've talked to, so that's helpful. Let me switch topics entirely now that we have you here with your background, and address a question that I think is long-term very serious for the American economy. And the short-term label on it is called sovereign wealth. As we see countries, by virtue of the oil prices, become very, very wealthy, we think of the Middle East countries, but we also have to include Russia in this category. We see a change in the underlying economic structure. Instead of wealth being held in the hands of shareholders who have an agenda to increase the wealth, we see wealth held in the hands of governments who have political agendas as to how they will use the wealth. And if I may draw a comparison to two competing examples, ExxonMobil, when it makes money off of oil, uses that money to try to find more oil. Hugo Chavez, when he makes money off that oil, uses it to try to destabilize South America and become the next Fidel Castro. And we're seeing foreign governments making purchases that have political implications. This is not the Japanese buying Rockefeller Center. I remember everybody being all upset in the 80s. The Japanese have bought Rockefeller Center. And I said, yes, and what are they going to do about it? Are they going to jackhammer it up and take it to Tokyo? They're stuck with it. It's in New York. And as it turned out, they sustained a fairly significant loss on the value of Rockefeller Center after they bought it. But in today's world, you can buy a company, you can dominate an industry that is worldwide, and then inject into that a geopolitical agenda rather than an investor's agenda, that could make your job significantly more difficult. I'm sure you've had some thoughts on this down at the Fed, and I'd appreciate it if you'd share some of those with us.
Certainly, Senator. This was a topic of discussion at the G7 recent meetings, sovereign wealth funds, which are there quite a variety of them. You know, Norway has one, for example, but of course many of them are based on oil revenues or foreign exchange currency revenues. The view of the G7, and we asked collectively, we asked the IMF and other institutions to work with us on this, is that sovereign wealth funds need to have a code of conduct that describes how they go about investing in other countries. That code of conduct includes transparency, so we know what they're doing, governance, so we know how they're controlled and to what purpose, and importantly, to the issue that you're referring to, that their investments be economically oriented, economically motivated, that is, in order to make a profit or a return as opposed to gain control of an important company or industry. So I believe it's very important that the sovereign wealth funds follow that type of behavior. And in return for that, I think we need to keep our markets open, and when they are, you know, investing as good investors and good citizens, that we should allow them access to the Rockefeller Center if that happens to be what they want to buy next. But it's an important issue because they are now larger than hedge funds collectively, and the way that they conduct their investments will, you know, will be very important as we go forward. But again, I understand your issue. The reform of CFIUS that recently took place tries to address the national security aspects of this. So I think the combination of code of conduct by the sovereign wealth funds, national security protections along the lines of CFIUS, but otherwise open financial and capital markets in the United States that will attract foreign investment, I think those are the elements that will allow us to make this work.
Thank you. My time is up. I just make this one quick comment. Of the oil companies that dominate the world now, those that are owned by shareholders like ExxonMobil represent a small percentage. The dominant oil companies are Gazprom and Pemex and companies of that kind. And as we beat up on American oil companies as if they really control the market, we should understand the market is being controlled by foreign governments.
Congresswoman Sanchez.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To some extent, I would like to associate myself with the remarks of Congressman Paul earlier about some of the things that have been going on structurally, because I think that's really where the problem is. I also would like to say that I represent Orange County, which is headquarters to probably all of the major builders, even in the United States. We export construction of new homes in particular from Orange County. I'm also the home of four mortgage originators, AmeriQuest and 21st Century and so many others. And I represent Anaheim and Santa Ana, California, which one out of every three homes up for sale right now in those two cities, or 33%, are from foreclosure. So this is really, really hitting home. And by the way, I just was out to purchase a home in the last 10 days, and I have an 800-plus credit score. I have no debt, basically. I have a lot of assets. And I went to the one institution where I carry a small loan with them, home loan, and they quoted me a price 100 basis points over what's quoted in what we're talking about as far as rates in the paper, in the newspapers. So if there's a credit crunch on for somebody like me, there's really a credit crunch on for people trying to work out of their homes and trying to save their credit or trying to save their home. I think this is a very, very big problem for us. And, of course, Bill Gross, a big Republican and CEO of PIMCO on Monday, basically told us that, you know, he thought he would foresee this for another 2 or 3 years, and we're really not anywhere close to the bad part of this, as well as some of the home builders, the new builders, who tell me I was selling product at $1 million, new product at $1 million. And today, Loretta, you can go down and the same product I'm selling for $700,000 5 miles out of your district, in Orange County, near the coast, not one of those places where you're out in the middle of nowhere, and they're really having problems. So I think we've really got a problem on our hands. But this generates, I think, from really bad policy, fiscal policy coming out of Washington, D.C., in particular over the last 6 years. I really have to say that. And Chairman, you're at the Federal Reserve, but you were the advisor to the president on this. I think we have some real problems here, structural problems. I think the decline of the dollar is only beginning. And I would ask you, I mean, I have lots of questions, but I don't have time because we have a vote on the floor. But I would ask you that in your private meetings, you get this administration to understand they need to invest in their people's health. They need to invest in their people's education. We need to invest in transportation, in communications, in things that make our people more productive. And we need to stop wasting our money. Mr. Hinchey said $2 billion a month in Iraq, $3 billion a week of operating expenses in Iraq. That isn't even going to my defense contractors for future systems weapons in California. No, that's operating, and it doesn't come back to the United States. Please, in your private meetings, you have a different role now, but in your private meetings, we need to get this administration to understand we cannot continue to spend and not invest in our people and in our country. And that's what I would like to tell you this morning.
In the interest of getting everyone to vote, both the House and the Senate now have a vote, I would ask that we take a brief recess. I know the Senate has one vote. I think I can get back here rather quickly, as can other members. Mr. Chairman, I know you have other engagements. You were able to stay here till 12:20. That's my understanding. Is that okay? We'll take a brief recess and resume. Thank you.
Apologize for having these votes and running back and forth. Mr. Brady.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Mr. Chairman, thank you for being here. So far, about $50 billion of losses have been identified in subprime loans at this point. Some estimates say the final amount may be equal to the savings and loan defaults that totaled about $150 billion. Do you think that, is that in the ballpark of what you estimate to be eventually declared?
Yes, that's in the ballpark, although I would emphasize that there's no reason to think that that would all be at financial institutions. It's been spread around to a lot of investors of different types.
And you see that impact working through our economy till the second quarter of next year?
Well, it's not the financial losses per se, but rather the weakness in the housing market that will keep construction on the downtrend probably into at least early next year.
Do you see there being a maturing market for these mortgage assets that are basically illiquid at this point? I know that Secretary Paulson is working to create the master liquidity enhancement conduit. Is there a way to, does the Fed see a way to accelerate a mature market where we see the true value of the assets that are being held?
Well, first I should say the markets are doing, the markets are working hard to achieve that. Asset-backed commercial paper market, for example, has stabilized, and a lot of the bad paper or weaker conduits have unraveled, and the stronger conduits have now stabilized and are being funded. With respect to the Federal Reserve's role, we, along with other bank regulators, the SEC, the accountants, and so on, our job is essentially to look at it from the perspective of the banks and the other financial institutions and make sure that they, both on their own balance sheets and through the conduits in which they have interest or which they sponsor are appropriately marking down assets according to the best available prices or measures of value.
How long do you think it will be before we see the true value of those assets? Obviously depreciated, but do you expect that to be occurring in the next quarter significantly, or?
Well, again, speaking from the point of view of financial institutions, I think they are being aggressive in marking down their assets, and based on what they can see, they have, in most cases, disclosed the losses that they have. The possibility remains that individual assets will continue to be marked down as they get downrated, for example, which will require rethinking. But I do believe the financial institutions are being aggressive, and it's very much in their interest to get that information out as fast as possible.
Does an initiative like the Master Liquidity Enhancement Conduit, I'm just trying to understand, I understand the creation of it. Do you think that accelerates the true value of these assets or delays them a bit?
As I discussed earlier, I think it depends on the execution. If it does involve the oversight of investors and a range of financial institutions, then ideally the assets should go into the MLEC at a fair value, at a market value. So if it works properly, I think it would speed up the recognition of values, in part because it would remove some of the risk of fire sales, of rapid drawing down of assets in some of these vehicles, and allow the market to stabilize and begin to make a better longer-term valuation of what some of these assets are worth.
Final thought on the subprime. I know that you've given it both thought and action. You know, Congress, I like most members of this body, are a big believer in home ownership and for all the many benefits of it. And it seems to me Congress, through our policies and encouraging regulation, tax incentives, we've encouraged home loans and business loans to borrowers who, don't have a strong credit history, and all with the worthy goal of increasing lending to those constituencies. But given the weakness that this crisis has revealed, from income verification to lax underwriting to credit suspect credit ratings, to what extent have congressional policies, such as the Community Reinvestment Act or truthfully any other policy, what extent have congressional policies played a role in the subprime crisis?
That'd be very difficult for me to judge. What I'd like to say is that lending to people without long, well-established credit histories can be both profitable and socially beneficial. And we've seen that. We've seen responsible subprime lending, and we've seen subprime credit extended in other areas as well. We've also seen at least the reduction of redlining and those similar issues that were a problem in the past. So I think, again, it depends on execution. Banks can lend to underserved populations, but the rules of creditworthiness and underwriting still obviously apply, and we've learned that lesson in the last couple of years.
Well, I ask that only because Congress taken the approach of sort of going after the market on this, and there's substantial merit to that, but I just wonder if it's time for Congress to reassess our policies. I mean, is it time, to require a down payment? Do we have a more substantial asset test when you take out a variable rate mortgage? Because there you're not only open to the economies, but you risk the interest rate fluctuations as well. Is it time for Congress to take a look, sort of look back at the basics of how we can both encourage home ownership, but lessen the risk of bad loans?
Well, two comments. One is, going back to the CRA issue, a lot of the subprime lending was done by non-bank lenders who have no CRA obligations, and so obviously in that case there was no CRA effect. As far as underwriting is concerned, you can't really legislate good underwriting, but you can require, for example, that lenders take an appropriate account of ability to repay and, sure, and so on, and that is in some of the bills that are there, but it's also something we're looking at the Federal Reserve in our regulatory process that we expect to have next month release some rules.
Senator Casey.
Thank you. In that analysis, will there be any recommendations for Congress, Chairman?
No, just some rules.
Great. Thanks. Thanks, Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Casey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate the opportunity to participate in this, make sure that's on, in this hearing. And Mr. Chairman Bernanke, we appreciate your patience with us voting and having a brief recess. I just have two areas to cover. One, of course, is on the subprime crisis, and then I have a second area to cover. I wanted to, first of all, highlight some of your testimony. On page 6 of your testimony in the section that deals with subprime borrowers, you say at the end of that first full paragraph, and I quote, should the rate of foreclosure rise proportionately, communities as well as individual borrowers would be hurt because concentrations of foreclosures tend to reduce property values in surrounding areas. A sharp increase in foreclosed properties for sale could weaken the already struggling housing market and thus potentially the broader economy, unquote, which is what your testimony was. And I thought that was a good summation of what this crisis means for individual families in their communities, but also the larger impact on the economy. I just wanted to direct your attention to two charts. The first chart is a map that was developed by this committee, the projected economic costs of the subprime mortgage crisis state by state. I note that Pennsylvania is around $2.5 billion. Other states higher than that. The overall numbers, for those who can't see it, for the third quarter of 07 till the third quarter of 09, loss in home value, loss in neighboring property values, loss in property tax value. The overall number, based upon this research, it can be summarized this way. $71 billion in housing wealth directly destroyed because of the foreclosures reducing the value of the home, $32 billion in housing wealth indirectly destroyed. We know these numbers. I thought this was a graphic presentation of what it means state by state and nationally. And you know that as well, Mr. Chairman. And I do note in your testimony, and I was grateful that you highlighted a lot of the strategies that are being employed now, pages 7 and 8 and 9. Loan workouts, loss mitigation techniques, repayment plans, temporary forbearance, loan modification, work with community groups. I'd note that Senator Schumer and I and Senator Brown have worked on legislation, but in addition to that, push to have $100 million, actually we wanted $300 million, into the budget became $100 million to help fund these community groups that are trusted by homeowners and people within that community, but also have some certifiable expertise. So you highlight a lot of the strategies that banks and financial institutions are employing, work that the Fed has done, work that the Congress could do, especially with the Federal Housing Administration. And I say all that just as a preliminary backdrop to the question. If someone in Pennsylvania or any other state is watching your testimony today, and even though you've covered this broadly and specifically, I'd ask you just to restate what you can tell them that you're trying to do, the Fed's trying to do, to deal with the immediate impact. A lot of what we talk about here will prevent this from happening again, we hope, and we're working on that. But what can you tell them now that the Fed is doing in the immediate or near term to help those who have already been the victims of not just the crisis, but the impact of the reset on their bottom line, families? Just a summary.
If I were speaking to someone in that situation, the first thing I would say to him is get in touch with your lender, because the experience shows that the earlier you get in touch, the more quickly and more likely it is that you can resolve the issue. And indeed, the banks tell us that one of their big problems is that nobody will respond to their calls, and they find it very difficult. So I would urge that piece of advice on your constituents. with respect to the what the Fed is doing, obviously our first responsibility is to try and maintain a healthy economy, which will help reduce the costs that you allude to. But in addition, as I discussed in my testimony, we are quite active. As you know, we have reserve banks around the country in the different regions of the country, and we have been quite active in working with those community groups that you mentioned, trying to help them identify strategies, help them identify communities where the problems are most severe and where their efforts should be concentrated, trying to help with their training. We have convened groups at the Fed and other places. I've spoken myself to many, many different people about the barriers to refinancing, for example, the accounting and other barriers. The Fed was one of the first to bring forward this issue about FAS 140, which is an accounting provision that can impede refinancing. So on all these dimensions, we are doing what we can as a central bank to assist in resolving this problem, which your characterization, I've read the JEC report, it properly characterizes this as a very, very important problem that has implications not just for individuals but for the broader economy as well.
Do you foresee any other further interventions either that the Fed is planning or would at least contemplate or seriously consider?
Well, we hope to that our actions to stabilize financial markets and the economy will help the credit crunch situation we see now. We hope to see that improve over time. It would be very nice to see the secondary markets for prime jumbo loans, for example, to open up again and begin to see more activity. One of the problems right now is that creditworthy borrowers who would like to refinance out of a subprime ARM are finding it very difficult to do so because of tightened credit terms. Credit terms should be tight and underwriting should be good, but to the extent that there's an artificial reduction in the supply of credit associated with the financial market situation, we hope that our policies will lead over time to a more normal, better functioning financial system. Thank you.
And I have one more question. I want to turn to a second chart. The staff of this committee makes great charts. We want to make sure we use them. This one is very simple but profound in its impact. The gap, and anyone who can differentiate between red and blue on this chart can see it, the gap between productivity, which has been rising as we see since the late 90s, compensation per hour rising but not nearly as significantly. That gap between the blue, the higher line, the blue line, and the red line, I think is an academic way of expressing profound frustration and anxiety that a lot of families feel, where they feel they're working harder than ever before. The data supports that, the productivity and output numbers support that, but their bottom line is not growing. And then on top of the wage stagnation or failure to grow, they have higher health care costs, even though they've leveled off, higher college tuitions, the stories about an increase in fuel per, the average family paying maybe 11% more this year, I saw in one report yesterday. I'd ask you, this is a tough question to answer briefly, but I'd ask you to choose one of two options, because I know you have some limitations on what you can say, but in the context of either what Congress can and should be doing to reduce that gap between productivity and wage growth, or if you cannot make such a recommendation or don't feel comfortable doing that, just a general philosophical statement about what can we do as a society and as a government to try to bring those two lines together to have higher wage growth in the context of higher output.
I was asked a little earlier about what Congress could do to address these broader problems. You pointed to some of the issues that are hurting middle-class living standards. One, of course, is energy. And that has been a big problem throughout this period, and certainly I know the Congress is working on energy policies and trying to find ways to provide alternative sources of energy and that would be more economical in the long run. You mentioned health care, where the costs continue to rise. That's part of our inflation issue, and we measure those costs in our inflation index. certainly there are numerous reforms that could be undertaken. It is far too much to try and address in 15 seconds, but to address that very important problem. And I've spoken on a number of occasions, and doesn't directly address your issue, but certainly there's been a lot of concern about the rise in inequality in our society, and part of that, at least, is the result of the increasing return to high education and skills that we see in our modern technological globalized economy. And although it's a medium to long-term solution, I do think that education and training and skill creation is critical for creating a broad-based prosperity in this country.
Thank you.
Thank you very much,
Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Senator Casey. We want to thank you. I know you have to leave at 12:20, so I just have a quick question here. In your testimony, you suggested that GSEs might be allowed to securitize jumbo loans with the federal government acting as guarantors. I think that's a very good idea. In fact, legislatively, it's something that I would try to introduce and get passed. Do you have any idea of how high that ought to go for all loans, even $2 or $3 million mortgages?
That's up to Congress, but certainly.
What would be your thought?
Million dollars.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your patience. We had a series of votes. We very much appreciate your being here. Thanks. Great. Thank you.
It is 12:53 p.m. It is 3:37 p.m. It is 3:38 p.m.